Good afternoon, everyone. I'm Asha Nayaswamy, and I'm broadcasting from a non-Palo Alto community. I'm with my friend Keshava Betts today. We're trying something a little bit new, which is because the Ananda community has been in existence for 50 years, we're running, you know, into our third generation of people coming at a relatively young age and making their lives at Ananda, either because in a handful of cases, including Keshava, they were born and raised there, or more commonly, people are drawn to it the same as I was drawn, without any biological or family connection to it, just drawn by God. And even though we're dealing with a teaching that's thousands of years old, that's endured the rise and fall of quite a few civilizations, thousands at a minimum, and the reason human nature doesn't change that much, nonetheless, there's a lot of differences, age-related differences from a cultural perspective, and even more importantly, from a I was born for this perspective. And I've thoroughly enjoyed my conversations with everybody whose perspective in life is different than mine, and this group of what, for lack of a better word, we're calling millennials, who are dedicated to Ananda, but whose upbringing and whose point of view and whose life experience is really different than what I call my tribe. My tribe, their tribe, we're united in our aspirations and our understanding of life, but we really come at it from different angles. I think the present adventure for the world, I'm 72 years old, I'm going to watch the first act, but the people who chose to incarnate to be millennials at this time are actually looking at their future and at their destiny. And so I thought some of those conversations could be really, really interesting. So we're going to find out today. So I'm going to be your interviewer, and I'm going to ask the questions I hope that you want to ask, you want to have answered, and I'll just start. Okay. So you are?
I'm Keshava.
Keshava. And where were you born? Where did you grow up?
I was born at Ananda Village, the original Ananda Village up in Northern California. And I grew up there. I spent 2 years at Ananda Portland, and then my family came back to Ananda Village. And I grew up there until I was about 16. I went to Los Angeles to pursue a career in acting.
Are you still pursuing your acting career?
Nope. That karma just suddenly vaporized out of my heart one day.
Why?
I think it just was no longer going to provide me with the growth I needed as a soul. And literally, just one day, I was driving my car out of Yosemite National Park, and I felt what I can describe best as, it felt like a bubble popped in my heart, and I felt energy rise up my spine, and when it reached my spiritual eye, the thought in my brain came and said, I don't have to be an actor anymore. And just like that, the desire was just gone.
Just like that?
Just like that. And it has never come back, and there was no doubt about it. It was just, oh, it's gone.
It's gone.
And I don't need to pursue.
Did you feel that you learned what you needed to learn from being an actor?
I do. I think I learned a lot. Some really valuable lessons. And I also got to meet some very valuable people that taught me some great things.
And what did you do when you stopped being an actor?
Well, then I dedicated my life to serving Yogananda more directly, which was really a deeper expression of what I was seeking in the acting. And that's really what I realized. I think that's why I no longer desired to act anymore, because I found a more refined version, expression of what my heart was yearning for anyway.
Put into words what your heart was yearning for.
I have wanted for a very long time to help people overcome suffering and to feel their own inherent inspiration, and that life is good and that joy can be achieved. And I thought that acting was the way to show joy in human experience, and that it was possible to perceive beauty even in suffering, you know. And but then I discovered that we didn't need to tell stories to do that. We needed to help people see themselves to do that, which acting was only a vehicle for. But something like meditation or philosophy or yoga is a more direct way of experiencing that for yourself.
So even though you were born and raised at Ananda, you had this interlude of time where you were pursuing a more, what you would call, normal life?
Yeah.
Do you think that was an essential step?
I think so. I really wanted to be successful in the world. And my justification was that I wanted to use my success to spread a higher consciousness.
Mm-hmm.
But I think really there was a part of me that just wanted to enjoy fame and success and money and all these things. And I just began to realize that what was more valuable to me was these deeper, more eternal principles that I could share more directly through this other way. So that's a little bit about that. But yeah, no, it was very important for me to exercise individuality because it really helped me discover Yogananda's teachings for myself, how they applied to my life. And it also, and I don't mean to sound like cynical, but it also helped me realize that there weren't really viable other options.
Uh-huh.
Because I got to spend time with some incredible artists and some wonderful people, but there was always a pain or a yearning that couldn't be overcome in those fields. And I remember being in my group of, my troupe of actors, and they would describe their suffering, and I just knew what they needed was God. but you couldn't say that because they didn't want to hear that.
Right.
And so, but I had to really balance this awareness in myself that what we were all seeking was the divine. And basically, I just had to come to realization in my own self that what I was seeking was the divine. So if I wanted to help other people find that, I should probably like walk the walk myself and just do it.
That would be a good idea.
Yeah.
You know, in the interest of full disclosure here, I have to say that even though I actually didn't meet Keshava again until the last couple of years, I knew his parents before either he or his three brothers existed.
Yeah.
So I'm going to ask you this question here. Do you think the reason you follow this path is just because your parents did?
No, no. I think this is my soul's from before I was born. And the reason I think that is because from as far back as I can remember, I would look into Master's eyes and just offer myself to him, even when I was a boy. Mm-hmm. One of my very earliest memories when I was probably 2 or 3 years old is lying outside gazing at the blue sky and chanting, "My Krishna is blue."
Mm-hmm.
And I would chant those words, "And when I die, O Mother, do put me high on the branch of the tamal tree." I didn't even know what the heck that meant, but I could feel that that was for me, and I knew it was mine. And then when I got older, I started having experiences where like Master and this line of gurus would like come and shake me. And my own desire to be popular or to fit in with my social circles made me resist that call, and eventually it just became so futile that I surrendered.
That you surrendered to?
Yeah, I mean, some people say like, oh, I found Master through this, or I found Master through that, and I'm like, he came and knocked my door down.
Do you think being born at Ananda, let me think how to say this, disqualifies you from speaking to people who weren't?
No.
Why?
I don't think so.
Why?
Well, because I think I have experienced, I mean, I don't know the play very well, but in The Merchant of Venice, one of the characters says, who's being persecuted for being Jewish, he says, "Has not a Jew eyes?
Mm-hmm.
Has not a Jew ears? Like, don't we all feel? Aren't we all the same inherently?" And so I think just because I was born in Ananda Village doesn't exclude me from being sympathetic to the human condition.
Right.
I just think it means that my soul suffered enough in past lifetimes and didn't quite reach exit velocity to to have begged for the divine to, like, you know, give me a springboard in this one.
Well, you know, your position in that respect is slightly, somewhat like mine, because I met Swami 50 years ago when I was 22,
yeah.
So I never really lived a, quote, normal life. But when you get to the center of things, it's like everything on the periphery is included from the center.
Yeah.
So you're not really different. The human condition is what it is.
Yeah.
Okay. And this is a question I will probably be asking a lot of people as we go through this. What do you think the main difference is? Because just let me say this first. What you describe about awakening and longing and all of that, I mean, that's my story too. That's everybody's story.
Yeah.
It's just the way it is. I wanted certain things because I wanted what I thought they would give me.
Yeah.
And then I gradually lost interest in those things but I've been very consistent about what I was really looking for.
Yeah.
It's just that I over time learned that the form had to change.
Yeah.
And I feel that's been true all the way through. The form has changed repeatedly, but the inner impulse has always been the same. It's just a gradually awakening to how most efficiently and effectively to achieve it, you might say.
Right, exactly.
Right. But there are, and I've learned, cultural differences, social differences, etc. So what's the main difference between the group that you represent culturally and chronologically versus my upbringing in my world? What do you think? Just give me one example. You don't have to give me every example.
Well, that's an interesting thing to contemplate. We were talking about this a little bit the other day, but I think one of the big differences that I've observed in my generation is we have such an outlet for intense, vivid experiences through a virtual platform that I think I've noticed a lot of my peers and myself when I was younger chasing experiences that we ourselves aren't even doing. And so, like, it's the satisfaction that comes from achievement in the real world takes a lot of delayed gratification. I'm using the wrong words here. It takes perseverance, and you learn life skills, and you have to apply yourself, and then when you're finished, you have a real product. But one big thing that I've noticed in my generation that's been very prominent in my awareness is with the boom of technology. I remember when I was like 10 or 11 years old, a very popular video game was released.
Mm-hmm.
And I went from being the kid who would always play outside and play soldier with sticks.
Mm-hmm.
But that would require the use of our imagination and our bodies and our physicality, to then all of a sudden it was like, why would we want to play outside when we could use a video game and the video game's imagination is better than ours? And so then all of a sudden we went from spending hours a day outside scrambling over rock and valley with sticks,
uh-huh,
to spending 10 hours a day in front of a screen.
Wow.
And that was a really interesting thing to go through. And I finally got really sick of it.
I have to ask you a question.
Yeah.
Now, like, I got a computer right at the very beginning because somebody gave me a small Apple. You know, one of those little things that you can use for a doorstop now.
Okay.
You know, it was like a gift, an anonymous gift to me. It appeared on my doorstep one day, this little tiny. So I was on a Mac writing because I was a writer even then, and it was great. The only video game I remember is a ping pong game back and forth.
Right.
So I literally don't know what you mean when you talk about a video game. So give me just like what it means to you. What does it feel like?
So one of the big revolutions that happened in video games as far as I witnessed was the invention of what is called like a first person shooter game, which is that the perspective is that you are the hero, you are the gunman, and that in your view, all you see are the arms of the character and the weapon you're holding.
Good Lord.
And as you progress through the game and you shoot and kill and destroy things,
right,
it's you pulling the trigger.
Wow.
I've only heard of some studies, but like Dr. Peter referenced how the brain can't differentiate between that stimulus and real life.
Wow.
And I haven't read these studies, but I did hear, just as a fascinating aside, that in like World War II, one of the biggest problems the U.S. Army faced was getting their new recruits to discharge their weapons on their first encounter.
Wow.
And that apparently like 98% of new people could not fire their weapon at another human being.
Right.
Because the consequences of shooting another person were so high, they just couldn't do it. But after enough exposure to such a brutal environment, then they became desensitized.
You mean actually being in war?
Yeah, the soldiers, after being in battles, would learn to fire their weapons.
And probably they saw people next to them being killed, and that would arouse a certain, this is worth doing.
Like necessity.
Yeah, exactly.
But then what was interesting is after the first-person shooter games became popular in the U.S., again, I've only heard this secondhand, I heard that that demographic switched, and that 98% of new recruits did fire their weapons in the first encounter because we became desensitized to the idea of pointing a weapon at another living creature and pulling the trigger. And so for me, like as a young boy, that's exhilarating. Like, it gets your adrenaline system flowing. Mm-hmm. Like, it's vivid and exciting. And then the other thing is there's no consequences.
Right.
That if you're killed, you just have to wait 3 seconds and then you get to try again.
Wow.
And I've noticed in people who do these things a lot, or in myself when I would play those games a lot, it just totally overstimulates the nervous system and can create these incredibly exaggerated reactions to something that has literally no value in your real life.
Okay, I want to think about that for just a second. It's extremely interesting. I want to hold your thought because I want to insert a thought here, which is very important. The Bhagavad Gita talks about righteous war.
Yeah.
So we're not talking pacifism necessarily here. There are times when it's necessary.
When war is necessary, yeah.
And for some people, war is their dharma. It's the right thing to do. Multiple times, Yogananda himself incarnated as a fierce general and led people into battle. Okay, so that's one condition. The other condition, and this is me, who's never raised children, but I have a lot of friends who've raised sons, and boys, especially boys, but all souls, but especially the influence of the masculine energy. Let's forget, let's try to be gender neutral, but let's just say that the influence of masculine energy is that in order to be triumphant in life, we have to have courage, we have to face, we have to overcome.
Yeah.
So when little boys play war, they're playing courage.
And I think we learn a lot of great things in that.
That's exactly right. So we want to understand that that's valid. Even Yogananda, there was a story about a little boy who lived in the ashram with him, who was playing with, play guns, and his mother, who was there as a nun, was completely worried about it.
Right.
So Yogananda brought the little boy in and said, I saw you playing out in the hall. What are you doing? And he said, I'm protecting you from the bad guys.
Yeah.
And so what Master said to him was, then I'd really like it if you'd stand right behind me when I sit down to eat.
Oh.
So he let the little boy be his bodyguard right behind him because he knew what qualities the boy was developing.
Was cultivating, yeah.
Yeah. Selflessness. What it looked like from his point of view.
Yeah.
So now go on with what you were
saying. Well, and I totally relate to that. Before, when I was playing outside with my friends, we would play soldier and we'd play survival scenarios, and inevitably there might come a point in the game, in our imagined game, that somebody would have to sacrifice themselves for their friends.
Mm-hmm.
But when you're playing that, it has a much more real sense of nobility and sacrifice, mm-hmm. because you're actually the one laying down, and now I am dying and the story has to go on. But when you're playing in a video game, there's no sense of consequence or self-sacrifice or nobility that comes through, because it's too impersonal, it's detached. And my best word is that there's no consequences to it. It doesn't require energy.
Mm-hmm.
That even just little things, like I think a young boy would gain a lot more from going outside and learning how to shoot a bow and arrow really, really proficiently than playing a video game where you shoot a bow and arrow.
Because
at least he's using his body and things like that.
And his concentration of a different kind.
Yeah.
And he has to deal with failure, and he has to deal with embarrassment, and then he has to overcome it, all of which are qualities of consciousness.
Yeah.
Now, this is our first conversation.
Yeah.
It's a 30-minute broadcast. So we're not going to... I'm only saying that because I want those of you who are listening to realize that this is an unfinished conversation.
Yes.
And we're not here to say technology is a bad thing.
No.
Necessarily. We're exploring the influences on people's consciousness that they may or may not be aware of. So, did you yourself spend years and hours of your life playing video games?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Many more than I would like to admit.
Uh-huh.
And what was... Because I have a... an intense personality that likes to do things with gusto.
Uh-huh.
And so when I would play video games, I didn't want to just play them. I wanted to dominate them.
Uh-huh.
And so I became fairly good at them when I was doing it. But what really struck me was when I would come out of playing, I would be left with this sense of lack and purposelessness. Like, I just spent an entire weekend doing absolutely nothing. And what do I have to show for it? That's really what I started asking myself. What do I have to show for all that time I invested?
Mm-hmm.
I have nothing.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what really started waking me up was, these games are designed to be addictive,
mm-hmm.
to be, enticing, and to always be putting the next carrot in front of you. But even after investing hours, I haven't grown as a person. And I have nothing of real value to show, or I haven't discovered some deeper part of my own being. And so I started pulling myself out of that basically because I was so hungry for a more lasting experience of success in some form.
Success. Well, you were pursuing outer success, so it was a multi-level thing that you were working on.
Yeah.
Did you have difficulty pulling yourself out of it?
At first, perhaps, but I found, well, it's actually funny, I kind of stopped all of that right at the same time I started meditating. And I think that was sort of a convenient, you know, switch, like when Indiana Jones switches the gold for the sand, except for I was switching sand for gold. But one thing that I noticed is... I couldn't just let it go without having something else that was just as interesting or more interesting.
There you have it.
And what I discovered was that one thing we were talking about the other day together that I think is worth saying again is these video games or technology puts at our fingertips an intensity of experience that's hard to rival in our ordinary lives. And so unless there's some way of achieving that intense experience, we're always left feeling like our lives are lacking in some way. But for me, meditation was really what offered me the road into a more fulfilling experience of my own life, because I could go into meditation and have a deep and powerful and very vivid experience of some inner reality that wasn't dependent upon a screen and a controller or things like that. And so, like, I remember my friends being a little baffled that I wasn't interested in doing drugs anymore. And on a certain level, I wanted to tell them, it's not that I'm not interested in doing drugs anymore, but like you said, I just found, like, a different way that just leaves me feeling better. and that is accessible to me when I need it. So, yeah, it was a process.
And it's cheaper and it doesn't have a backside.
Yeah, in fact, it only has an upside. Yeah, so... Yeah, there's a lot about that I've witnessed, and one thing that I think is really important is that playing in an alternate reality through video games or through any sort of technological stimulation really, I think, is disempowering to our ability to take responsibility for our own lives. And because it's just like escapism in a certain way. And it's fun to pretend, and there's nothing wrong with hobbies and like recreation, but I guess for me it just comes back to what are we really gaining out of it.
Do you think there's a characteristic of your tribe, which is what I'll call it, a characteristic of your tribe of not taking responsibility? Is it more extreme than other tribes?
I don't know, because I don't have it's hard for me to compare, because I don't have that awareness, but what I can see is I have seen what I would call a unfortunate tendency to play the victim in my generation of people. That there's a little lacking courage to just take control of our lives and to put out the requisite energy to change them, because it's hard to become a superhero in real life. It's hard to become a millionaire. It takes so many steps that we're not aware of, but in a video game, it's easy. And so, like, it's easy to work a minimum wage job and have no ambitions and then go home and become Superman in a video game. It's much harder to become Superman in real life.
Right.
And, you know, I think this virus is going to provide my generation with a really interesting opportunity, because we're going to be asked to step up in a big way and take responsibility for our lives and for the world as things continue. And it's like, this isn't a simulation anymore. This is not a drill.
And also, you know, there's already been this, a lot of economic indicators of, that the next generation will never have the wealth that my generation, and I mean, I'm your grandmother. I mean, if I'd had children, my children's generation, there's already been a lot of that. And I guess there's two ways to respond to it. One way to respond is say, no, I'm not a statistic.
Yeah.
I have magnetism. Or the other way to respond is, you stupid people have ruined it for me.
Yeah.
I mean, human nature is human nature. Age is not a factor.
Mm.
But Let me think what I'm actually asking you. You know, not everybody plays video games, but we're also talking about kind of a group karma and a group attitude here. Do you think that that's what you're speaking of?
Yeah.
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 It's a... Let me think what the thought is here. You know, these cultural influences really do, we take them in with the water.
Mm.
That's what I'm trying to say. And you, it sort of becomes an atmosphere around you. It becomes the challenge of the group.
Yeah.
You know, it's the group karma that has to be challenged. So is that sort of what you're talking about?
Yeah, and that's exactly it. And I've noticed the group karma seems to be that I think we're getting a little disconnected with reality on a lot of different levels.
Uh-huh.
And I've noticed it shows up in social interactions. It shows up, and I think my generation is probably very unhappy overall because we're so enamored with the facade and have so little real substance in our lives. Uh-huh. And that's demonstrated in social media.
Mm-hmm.
You know, people are more concerned with how many likes they get on a Facebook post than on how many friends like they're really willing to sacrifice for. And it leaves you feeling empty.
Right. No, we're generalizing.
Yeah.
It's necessary to generalize because darkness, the shadow is increasing, but so is the light.
Yeah.
The brighter the light, the shadow is also more intense too.
Mm.
So you and many others that I know, I mean, in fact, having watched the spiritual life for like 50 years, it's your tribe, there is a lot of spiritual karma there.
Yeah.
You guys as a group look a lot like we did.
Mm.
You know, I was one of my first in my crowd to drop out of college. I was one of the first in my crowd to drop out of society. I was way in the front of it, and there was a lot of people with me. In fact, the way one of my friends, the mother of one of my friends, put it, said, every family has, as she put it, lost one out of the mainstream. And she said, usually it was the brightest, most promising child in the family.
Mm.
That was how she put it to me.
Mm.
I thought that was extremely interesting, but there was a crowd of us who all had a very different destiny.
Mm.
So part of the idea of bringing on this broadcast and my talking to you and talking to others is I think there's a lot of people like you who haven't yet figured out what to do with what they're feeling.
I think so too. I started meeting them in Los Angeles. There's a lot of bright, high energy young people who just are seeking a greater experience of life, but haven't yet found the way to find it.
Right.
And I always felt like I was sitting on a gold mine, but didn't know how to share it.
Well, and my problem is, Ananda actually looks like an entity now. When I came, Ananda didn't exist.
Right.
We were a bunch of just weirdos out in the woods.
Right.
With Swami Kriyananda, who was of another generation than us, and he was our fearless leader, and there was nothing happening. We were just dirt poor and literally living in nothing, and it was fabulous because it was ours and we could make it whatever we wanted. 50 years later, we dedicate a big temple. I have a big temple here. We have a community. We have blah blah blah. So it looks like Ananda exists, but Ananda doesn't exist anymore today than it did 50 years ago. Mm. We just got more stuff,
but
all Ananda is the shared aspiration.
Mm.
And one of the reasons that I'm talking to you and will talk to you and to others here, I'd like you to tell people what Ananda is to you, that it isn't to me, that therefore will help people to understand there's an answer here.
Huh.
Hmm. Does that whole thing make sense?
That does. That's beautiful.
What do you think?
I think Ananda is the promise of a deeper experience of inner joy and inner fulfillment for me.
That's perfect.
Than I've ever found.
Yeah.
And it's the promise that you can find it and there are others who are seeking just as earnestly as you.
Right. And the form doesn't matter.
Yeah.
The form will take whatever form it needs to take.
Yeah.
And can be annihilated in a heartbeat. You know, with one candle burning out of control, forms can be dissolved.
Right.
But spirit is something else entirely.
Yeah.
All right, my friend.
Thank you, Asha.
Well, it's very nice to talk to you. We'll talk to you again. We're going to be online at noon, Monday through Friday, and Keshava will reappear, and in the meantime, others of his tribe will be showing up, and we'll be having more conversations with Asha, the Millennials Speak. Okay,
thank you.